The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, so this is the series, the three-week series on balanced practice that'll be drawn, where the teachings will be largely drawn from the Pali Canon. But it's also that if other people come to the later ones, that's okay. It's not like it's required that we're at all three of them. But this is a topic that's been really interesting to me in my own practice lately, and as I've been talking with people, I see that it's relevant for them too. So I thought to put together this series where we talk about the fact that the way practice unfolds tends to have, like, sometimes things that almost seem contradictory or paradoxical in the way the teachings sometimes point us to the left and sometimes point us to the right, and you can say, well, which is it? And there's a little bit of wisdom, I guess, involved in, you know, knowing how to develop our practice at a certain time. So I'm calling this balanced practice, you know, the fact that we need to have sometimes leftward motion and sometimes rightward motion. I'm just using that as an abstract thing. Today we'll talk about a specific area where there can be balance, and in the next 2 weeks we'll also talk about two other areas. So this points towards the fact that the Dharma is not just a set of sort of formulaic instructions to follow. You know, it's not paint by numbers here. We are engaging in something that's a whole way of life, and which changes throughout our practice and through when the conditions of our life change, and we may need to be practicing differently. And so I want to talk first a little bit about what this word balance means in Dharma practice. I'm guessing everyone here has a practice that, and have you been following the practice for at least a year or so? That's probably helpful to have a little bit of a sense of how practice can change even over the course of months. But there's no requirement of anything related to the suttas. But let's look at what balance is. And see, my mind, I have kind of a scientific mind, and at first I thought of balance like two scales, you know, those scales that have different pans on each side and they can balance. But it's not quite like that. It's much more dynamic. So I thought of three ways that balance isn't exactly. The first is that it's not a sort of a static, confined place that's achieved by pitting opposing forces against each other. You know, kind of like, you know, an equal measure, and so like the balance of a rock and a hard place, something like that. That's not quite what we're talking about. It's not going to be like that. It's also, though, not a perfectly calm, flat, boring landscape that we achieve by eliminating all forces that could move the mind in any direction. Sometimes people think that's where practice leads, to just this kind of totally bland, neutral mind. Not true. You know, the balance of zero energy is not what we're aiming for. And I don't think it's a sort of a doggedly middling way. You know, like, I don't want to go too far to the left or the right, so I'm just going to, you know, only put out a middle amount of effort, just stay right in the center all the time, you know, sort of continually trimming and restraining any energies that seem to be getting out of sight of some range that we've defined, you know, the balance of mediocrity, if you will. That's not it either. So it's a much more dynamic, responsive process that kind of optimizes the nourishment and flourishing of the person who's practicing. Maybe one image is a person standing on one leg. So at first, if you try to stand on one leg, you've never done it before, it's going to be a little unbalanced. There's going to be sort of large movement, and you may have to put your other foot down now and then. But with some practice, you can imagine that you can stand on one leg with fairly small corrections, right? It gets easier. And I think this is maybe an analogy toward having more sensitivity in practice and being able to keep a little more in balance, although that might be somewhat idealistic. I think at times our practice could go way in some direction anyway. Maybe it's more like standing on one leg while riding a skateboard, where the conditions are going to change. They'll be going down a hill sometimes or over rough terrain or whatever. And then just another aspect of the word balance is that balance can mean resolving something that was an apparent paradox or contradiction. So it looks like there's two different things being said, but with a broader view, they get united. We're going to see examples of that in each of the weeks. So maybe that gives us a little bit of a framework around which we're going to talk about this idea of balance. And so we're going to start with a particular topic today, which is faith and investigation, or faith and inquiry, if you will. And those are both words that need a little bit of unpacking, which we'll do. But essentially, what I'm aiming at here is our attitude toward practice and our engagement with the teachings. So how do we relate to instructions from teachers, to Dharma talks, suttas that we've read? All of these things play a role in guiding and shaping our understanding and our behavior and our practice. And so the question is, what is our relationship to them? Every one of us has some relationship to the teachings, and we're engaged with them in some way. So I'm going to poke at you a little bit during today. So for example, one relationship to teachings and to instructions is what I'm calling faith, but we could also call it trust or confidence, something like that. It doesn't mean exclusively blind faith, but there's kind of a sense of trust or willingness or openness in engaging with these instructions. So we have the attitude, for example, that the teachings might be wiser than us, and so we're going to kind of open and let them do their work on us. This is one attitude toward approaching the teachings. So to make it a little concrete, let me say, imagine that your teacher says to you, it would be good for you if you were to bow 108 times before you sit every time. You're going to sit, you're going to bow first for 108 times. And if you adopt the attitude of faith, so let me ask you first, if your teacher said that, this isn't, would you do it? This is an internal question for yourself. If your teacher said, bow 108 times before you sit on the cushion, and they're not watching, would you do it? So the attitude I'm talking about of what I'm calling faith would be that you just do it. You don't add your opinion about it. You don't try to analyze whether it's working. You don't play around with it, try different things, or start checking for results. You would just do it. So it takes some humility to do that, but the idea is that you're just going to let the process do its work on you. My father practices transcendental meditation, and he started a long time ago, probably almost 50 years ago. He went to one of those intro session courses for however many weeks it is, and he got his mantra with a group. And he never really got into the whole checking in and going on retreats. That wasn't really his thing. He just wanted to meditate at home. So he got his instruction, and he followed that instruction for 50 years. He's just been doing his 20 minutes every morning with his mantra. Now, his practice has not been the same for those 50 years. I've talked with him. Now that we both meditate, I've talked with him a little bit about it. And he says that things unfolded, you know, over time, but he always just did the same instruction, even though different things were happening in his mind. And I found that very interesting, you know, is that I think probably more of us in the West, where we're so immersed in all these different Dharma teachings and teachers and things we can listen to online and classes we can go to, we might benefit from doing the same instruction for 50 years. We might really. So I thought that was quite interesting. Of course, now my father has discovered Vipassana practice, where you're supposed to play around with things, and now he's like totally delighted and has all these other things going on. But for a while, it was just following that instruction. Now, it is true that in our practice, you know, even whatever practice you're doing, I have found that you really do have to be able to do things where you don't know the reason and you don't know the result, what it's going to be. And doing that might get a little or even a lot uncomfortable at times. And not necessarily from a teacher telling you to bow 108 times before you sit, which they do, by the way, in the Korean Zen tradition. But it could just come from the practice itself. You know, our mind, something opens in our mind or heart, and it, you know, it demands something that we weren't expecting and that we might not be totally convinced about. But we have to sit with this now. Anyone who's been on retreat knows that sometimes things come up, and you're sitting there and, okay, I just have to sit with this because I'm basically trapped here on retreat, and that was my aim in coming here. I have a friend who's a teacher who says that you know who your teacher is because it's the person that you will listen to even when you're completely crazy. So this points to the fact that the mind goes through phases and it's going to change, and there has to be something that you trust when that starts to happen, when the mind starts to change. Maybe you trust the person, your teacher, or maybe you trust the instruction. Okay, I'm just going to sit, I'm going to be mindful of this, whatever it is, or I'm going to do metta. I think if we don't have any of this quality that I'm calling trust, we won't progress very far, probably, on the path. So what is said about this in the teachings? You know, what do we see in the discourses? So the Buddha, there are examples where the Buddha was very clear that his followers need to have this kind of faith. Now, this teaching is given to monks, so people who have already ordained with the Buddha. It may not apply to people who aren't declared followers, but this is from Majjhima Nikaya 70, called Atthakitagiri. This is a sutta about monks who don't obey a particular one of the Vinaya rules. And it's a group that's been isolated with a couple of teachers, a couple of senior monks leading them, and they've decided to continue eating an evening meal, whereas the Buddha has declared that monks should be finished eating after the midday meal. And so the Buddha finds out about this, and there's kind of a discussion among him and the monks. So the Buddha declares that eating only food before noon is the way to be free from illness and affliction and to enjoy lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding. And he meets these monks who are not abstaining from eating at night, and he asks the leaders why they do that. And the leaders say, well, I'm paraphrasing, they declare that eating any time is working well for them. And they ask why they should abandon a benefit that is immediately visible here and now for one that is to be achieved at a future time. So they basically say to the Buddha, we're in the present moment, and you know, we see benefits in the present moment of eating dinner. Why should we restrain ourselves because there's going to be some future benefit from that? The Buddha is displeased with this, okay? And he describes a path that begins with faith in the teacher, and he chastises them for their lack of faith. So the implication is kind of your path didn't even begin because you don't have this faith in me. And he uses very strong language. He says it is not proper for disciples to haggle in this way. He uses the word haggle, which is a big deal for monks who have given up money, right? And he's accusing them of basically going into the marketplace. And he says, what you're saying is, if we get this, we will do it. If we don't get this, we won't do it. So he's saying they're bargaining about following his instructions. And then he asserts his own power, and he says, this is the part where you can listen inside how it resonates for you. For a faithful disciple intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, it is natural that he conduct himself thus. The Blessed One is the teacher, I am a disciple. The Blessed One knows, I do not know. And for someone who thinks this way, the teachings are nourishing and refreshing, and the disciple will go on to achieve the fruits of the path. So that's interesting, right? Mm-hmm. This is in a sutta, and we take the teachings as they come. And so we can ask, you know, how do we engage with language like that? You know, what does that feel like for us? Western lay teachers don't usually speak in that way. And if you could dismiss it and say, well, you know, this is the Buddha 2,600 years ago speaking to ordained monks who had violated one of his rules. Yeah, of course he's going to come down on them. And so I just ask you to sit with that feeling. You know, this is the teacher. I'm the disciple. He knows. I don't know. Do we ever have this attitude in ourselves? Maybe yes, maybe no. I'm not saying it's the best. We're going to get to the flip side of it. But it's just interesting to see that this is in there. You know, the Buddha had this sense that you're really giving yourself over to this. There's another way in which he asserts the value of a faithful or trustful attitude, and that's in MN 63, the shorter discourse to Malankaputta. And Malankaputta is the name of a monk. And so he was ordained, he was a monk already with the Buddha, but he was a sort of a philosophical, speculative type. And he goes to the Buddha, and he demands to know the answer to 10 philosophical questions before he will undertake, you know, continue to go forward with the teachings. And these are questions, I won't read them all, but they're questions like, is the universe finite or infinite? Are the body and the soul the same or different, or the body and the mind, or something the same or different? What happens to a Tathagata after death? You know, what happens to the Buddha when he dies? These kinds of things that were apparently hot speculation topics at the time. But, you know, not something that the Buddha talked about very much. And so Malankaputta comes and he says, these are my questions. You will tell me the answer to these questions, or I will disrobe. He actually threatens to disrobe. And the Buddha looks at him. The Buddha is annoyed by this. I'm projecting a little bit, but basically he's annoyed. And he asks Malankaputta if that was the bargain when he ordained. And Malankaputta has to admit that it was not. It was not. The Buddha did not say that if he ordained, he would learn the answers to these questions. So again, the Buddha is kind of asserting his power. Says, hey, you know, you took this vow. I didn't promise you anything. And then the Buddha makes a powerful analogy. He makes an analogy to, he talks about a man who is wounded by an arrow. So the man gets stuck by an arrow, and his friends and relatives bring a surgeon for him to get it out. And the Buddha supposes that the man says, I will not let the surgeon pull out this arrow until I know whether the man who wounded me was a noble Brahmin or a merchant or a worker. And he goes on and on about the man's hometown, his physical qualities, the type of arrow, the type of bow, the type of fletching on the arrow. And it goes on for so long that it gets really ludicrous. And you understand that the point of the paragraph is that this is ridiculous. Is that, you know, of course, if you're wounded by an arrow, you wouldn't be asking all these questions. Maybe a modern equivalent for us is demanding, you know, we're not going to get wounded by an arrow and ask these questions, but demanding to see all the neuroscience research before we're willing to engage in meditation. You know, there are people who obsessively read about whether mindfulness is really seriously proven to statistically significant way bring about better well-being. And then maybe they'll try it, you know. Or there are people who are very upset about the presence of rebirth in the teachings. And, you know, this was, you know, you can debate about why it's in there. Was it just common in India at the time? Is the Buddha actually saying it's true? But somehow it's very disturbing to them that the Buddha assumes people have multiple lifetimes, and they feel that this, until this is resolved or until someone says it's okay not to believe in that, they can't do this Buddhism thing. You know, it's like, that's it. Game over, or, you know, showstopper or something like that, before they're willing to just sit down and practice. So the Buddha concludes his interaction with Malankaputta by pointing out that he does not teach philosophical theory. Instead, he teaches people how to end suffering. He says, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. And then he gives a teaching on the Four Noble Truths. He says, this is what I've declared. I've declared that there is suffering. I've declared that there is a cause of suffering or an origination or an arising. You know, I've declared that there's a cessation and that there's a path. I have not declared whether or not the universe is finite or infinite, etc. Why not? Because it doesn't lead to the end of suffering. Okay? And so the this is a very strong image of the man wounded by the arrow. The implication is, of course, that we're the ones wounded by the arrow. He sees people like us who are still living in the world of our projections and living with ignorance, and he says, you know, this is a major problem that your mind is not free, and, you know, I'm here to give you the instructions to pull out the arrow, and you're asking me, is the universe finite or infinite? Is mindfulness statistically significantly proven to help reduce stress, etc.? It's an interesting thing to think. So when we think about that, you know, do I think of my situation as one with an arrow coming out of my chest and it's urgent that I find liberation or not? So in the suttas, so you read these things in the suttas, and there's this idea, I guess, then of just take the medicine. You know, it's an interesting message. You're not wise. That's the problem. And you have to just trust if you're going to really gain the transformational benefits of the practice. So I see this thread. It's only one thread, but it's a thread that runs through the suttas. And it's worth reflecting on the ways in which we're demanding to know things or have assurances before we're willing to just follow the instructions. And, you know, I can sense in myself that there can be a little bit of arrogance in my sense of, I know what's good for me. I know which instructions to do. I don't want to do that one. Mm-hmm. It's too hard. That one's probably not necessary. That one's probably just for ancient India, not for the modern world, right? So, you know, it's worth just being open to, you know, what is our attitude toward the teachings of that. So we're gonna talk about this a little bit now, and I'm gonna ask that we have 7, a perfect prime number. But I'm gonna ask that you get into, I guess, 2 groups of 2 and 1 group of 3, and I'll have a question for you to discuss, and maybe you can get into those groups first. Okay. So the question. Is when in your practice or in your life has it been good to just accept? Has there been a time when something amazing opened up that you could never have imagined and which your judgmental mind might have rejected? And it was really important that you trusted a process that was happening. And it doesn't have to be in your Dharma practice, and you don't have to offer your deepest, opening. At a time when, you know, in swimming lessons or in school or something where you just followed the instructions and something really good came of it, and you didn't let your skeptical mind get in the way. So maybe each person could offer something, and I'll just listen for when it seems like the energy's going down. Okay, go ahead. Great. It took a few minutes for you guys to get started, and then once you did, the room was just, it was really interesting. I know that's a hard one to start with, because I feel like, maybe it's a hard one to start with, because I feel like this is what I see when I talk with students and when I look in my own mind. It's just around this area, we have a lot of kind of scientific mindset or kind of the more skeptical approach or inquiry-based approach. But I'm curious if anyone has anything interesting to share about that. Or did you learn something in just trying to talk about it? Sorry, it looked like you were about to say something.
I was contemplating it.
Oh, okay.
I will. I was just sharing that for me, it was after a retreat about 4 years ago that I started doing a movement practice that came out of the retreat. It was a Qigong movement practice. And just kind of had some faith that, okay, it was going to help certain postural pain that I had. And so I committed to doing it. It was not that it was handed down to me, like, you have to do this, but rather internally the desire to do it came. And then rather than questioning that desire too much,
I just did it.
I just stuck with it, and to this point. Mm-hmm. And I have found, those days that I don't versus those days that I do, I notice that difference, and it's enough to give me, you know, while I'm not querying, you know, is this good for me?
Right.
Kind of natural
that
answer
causes
to the question.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I don't.
Mm. That's great. That's a great example, actually. Mm-hmm. It's just something that you felt drawn to do, but you haven't had to. You haven't really thought about it. You haven't gone and read all the studies that Qigong is so beneficial, and you just are using your internal feedback. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else?
I can only think of counter examples because in writing, what I'm familiar with, people who do writing are very, very dedicated and they always do what the instructor says, and the instructor will have big tall boots and a whip and they're standing there. You're on a dangerous horse and, you know, and you always do the exact thing. And so I'm kind of already used to that system, so I couldn't think. I can only think of exceptions. Because normally you just do what they
have
say,
to do what they're saying.
Or it's
dangerous.
And I'm thinking in Dhamma practice, I was thinking not so much, you know, you don't worry because you don't eat yourself for the most part. I mean, it could happen. I mean, 108 pounds maybe, but I almost wish it could be more that way that I find that maybe it's a Western thing that teachers are very, very, like, I want them to give me boundaries. It's like, oh, okay, just do it that way. You know, it's like, well, I can't sit still for very long. Well, don't worry about it. Just sit for a minute. Yeah, I almost wish there would be more.
Yeah,
you know,
if I were
dangerous. You know,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, interesting.
But there's a lot of worries. I mean, there have been abuses that I think people are self-conscious about that. And so, it's just so
Interesting. Yeah, it does depend on the practice.
Yeah, those are solid, I don't know.
No, I did once. Well, no, that was only a couple times I was in a group.
Yeah, there are times where the form is very exacting. Like
I went out to New Mexico once to a Zen place. It was just kind of strange, but they were still very nice. Well, yeah, the 6 feet in the wall, I thought it was a dumping.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting it, but.
But that's but like I think every vow and how you like step in.
And if you don't do it, your student is going to come and say,
beautiful.
Hey, you really should do it this way.
Beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a, you know, it's a letting go.
I love it.
Surrender to that form.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
I mean, it reminds me of Tai Chi when you learn from a teacher where every movement is just exact. I mean, every move is the same thing in a way, but that's a moving meditation. It's the same thing, you know, you walk into that sendo, you better walk in with that right foot and bow when you walk in. And I mean, I really love that, that you do that with a, it's this incredible consciousness. It's wonderful. But you would probably love that.
Yeah. Well, but it's a really touchy subject because, you know, you do that because you throw yourself into something. So you have to have a lot of trust in the beginning because it'd be very painful to do that and then to be disappointed. It's a fear of disappointment, right?
Yeah.
And
so well, we have
you did all these things and you do what they said and then and then in the end maybe you shouldn't have it or wrong or something.
That question
is a place, right?
It
I mean, and it's
kind of
our
trust,
very tender relationship.
It is, and we don't.
Yeah.
And we don't know what the outcome is going to be. I mean, when you said disappointed, that implies that we know what we think the result is going to be, and it may or may not be exactly that.
Not so much the result, the motivation maybe of the teacher.
Motivation,
you know.
It's not so much.
Yeah.
And it does need balance. Actually, that's what I want to talk about next is, this is actually a nice segue to the, you know, so total capitulation is not what the Buddha wanted either. So, you know, there is this thread that says, just take the medicine. You got the arrow coming out of your chest, just pull it out. And you don't see this consistently. It's not the only teaching in the suttas. So the Buddha really also wanted to foster people who were self-reliant. He didn't want a bunch of obsequious followers kowtowing to him who couldn't maintain their own practice and have some sense of what they were doing. It's very clear from other suttas that he valued people trying to figure it out for themselves. And even if they took some wrong turns along the way, he rewarded investigation and experimentation also. One clue is that we can notice that in the if you look at a lot of suttas, you'll see that many of them are about people coming to ask the Buddha questions. That was obviously a very common format, is that people would come and they, you know, give their reverential salutation and stand to one side respectfully, and then say, you know, how is samadhi achieved, or, you know, what are the factors that prevent concentration, or something like this. And the Buddha is very happy to answer that. You know, he wants people to come and ask questions. So this was an important mode of learning, a valuable mode of learning. And then there are also explicit suttas that talk about this. Like, I want to read a little bit from a pretty famous one called the Kalama Sutta. And this one, the Kalama were a group of people. It was like I don't know if the town was called Kalama, but the people were called the Kalama. And it was kind of a border town where they lived. And so a lot, like a trading, kind of a trading hub. And a lot of spiritual teachers came through. And they would, you know, give their evening Dharma talk or whatever. And they would all say, I'm telling you the truth. This is the one true way. These are the best teachings. And that guy who came last week, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's not really enlightened, you know, I'm hamming it up a little bit, but essentially they heard a lot. And the Buddha came one time, and they said, they were fed up at that point, and they said to the Buddha, you know, everybody who comes says something different. I suppose you're going to be the same. How can we tell who's telling the truth? How do we know whose instructions are correct? And the Buddha, very respectfully says, it is right that you would have doubt. It's natural that you would be doubtful in a case like this, because this is a situation that fosters doubt. So first he kind of, you know, says, yes, this makes sense to me, that you would be confused, that you've got a bunch of different people telling you different things. This sounds to me a little bit like the Bay Area, where, you know, every 200 feet there's a center of some kind. And they're not all consistent, and some are this and some are that, and people do all kinds of things because they get attracted, they want to try out this or that, and sometimes they arrive at a new center and they're really a little confused with everything that they've heard. So, but they've asked the Buddha a question and answer, and they've said, how do we know which teachings are correct? And so the Buddha tells them, he gives them more than they ask for. He tells them how they can tell something is not correct, and he tells them how they can tell it's correct. So he says, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement through pondering views or through reflection, by probability, or by the thought, this contemplative is our teacher. When you know for yourself that these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. And of course, the flip side for when you know for yourself that these qualities are skillful, praiseworthy, praised by the wise, etc., and when they carried out, they lead away from suffering, then you should adopt them. And when you listen to this, of course, you say, well, of course, you know that. How else would it be? But it's a very interesting set of criteria that he dismisses, first of all. He dismisses reports, legends, traditions, scripture. So, you know, like written stuff, traditional, we do it because the book says, they didn't have books then, but, you know. And then he dismisses logical conjecture, inference, analogies, reflection. So he dismisses rational thought, basically. Yeah. He says you can't just sit down and figure it out. You know, this is probability. I don't know what that refers to. Or by the thought, this contemplative is our teacher. So he dismisses the very method that he advocated in MN 70. He says, don't just say, because he's our teacher, we should follow him. Now, before you think this is inconsistent, I will point out that MN 70 was spoken to monks. So these were people who had ordained with the Buddha. They declared they were going to be his followers. These people are not Buddhists. The Kalama are just townspeople. So it's a little different situation. But nonetheless, he says to them, it's not because my authority as a teacher that you should believe me. He then says what you should do. When you know for yourselves that these qualities are unskillful, blameworthy, etc., So there's an experiential component of knowing something for yourself, although there's a little catch there in that it says these qualities are criticized by the wise, and the flip side, these qualities are praised by the wise. So it's not quite solipsism, is that the word, where your own experience is absolutely king. Mm-hmm. So it says, yes, go by experience and check with the wise. who are the wise? Well, you know. But basically he says, when something leads towards suffering, then don't do it. If it leads away from suffering, then do it. And so I really appreciate this, this approach. This is the approach of inquiry or investigation, where you try things. He doesn't say don't do anything or do only these Ten Commandments or whatever it is that he's, whatever it is he's advocating. He says try it out for yourself, notice if it's leading toward or away from suffering, and then act accordingly. So even he's admitting that sometimes we'll do something and find out that it leads toward suffering, and then we would say, oops, that wasn't right. So he's not saying you got to get it 100% right, which is a big relief, isn't it? He says, try it out, and then you have to look. Then you have to be mindful. Act, but act with awareness. Discern if something is leading toward harm or benefit. So we're to investigate. We're asked to investigate. I'll give another example of along these same lines. There's a sutta called MN95, the Chanki Sutta, which is spoken to, this is now a yet a different audience. It's spoken to Brahmins, actually, who were the kind of religious priests of the time. The Buddha was like, he was one of the ascetics who went out in the woods and lived, among the seekers out there. The Brahmins were the ones who lived in the city. They were the official. They did, ceremonies and all this stuff. And they had an oral tradition that where they memorized texts, the Vedic texts that had come down for generations. So this is by oral tradition, by scripture, etc. And they believed also that they had to really memorize these texts exactly, and they had to do the rituals very precisely, or it wouldn't get the right result. So that was kind of their whole practice. They were really focused in on that. And so the Buddha depicts, he's talking with a Brahmin student who's kind of defending this way of practice. And the Buddha responds with another one of his powerful images. And he depicts the Brahmin leaders as a line of blind men. He says, suppose there were a file of blind men, each in touch with the next. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, the last one does not see. So this is one of his nice flowery analogies. But basically he's saying, your leaders don't know what they're talking about. Because this is actually after the Brahmin student has admitted that the teachers have not directly experienced what they're teaching. Mm. So they're teaching these texts, you just memorize them. But he says, has anybody actually had the experiences that are described there? And he says, well, no. But we know these are holy texts, and we pass them down. And then the Buddha says, well, if nobody's seen it for themselves, it's not a valid teaching. Basically, it's pretty tough. He's pretty tough with the Brahmins sometimes. And so then he goes on from there to declare that his teaching is one of personal experience, of experiential learning, where you actually are expected to experience the results and see those things and then be able to speak from that place. So he's criticizing, essentially. He's criticizing this blind faith, this sense of not questioning what comes to you. So we have on the one hand the Buddha who declares, just take the medicine, and just follow what I'm saying, because this transformation is bigger than your little mind can understand. And then, I'm paraphrasing again. And then the other Buddha that says, investigate for yourself. You can always find it in your own experience. Use your discernment. Don't just listen to the teacher. So they're both there. It's interesting, right? So I thought I thought I would ask another question of you, if you're willing to break into groups again. You might try a different partner this time. So please find a different partner than last time, and then I'll give you the question. Okay, so the question is kind of the flip of the other one. It says, when did you need to dig in more and make assessments and ask questions? Were you ever too gullible? You know, did you ever have an experience of just accepting something? And it turned out that you really should have questioned it. You really should have used a little bit of wisdom. Can you think of a time in either your practice or your education or your regular life where investigation would have been good? Okay, thanks. That also got kind of lively. So it's interesting, right? There are these different sides. Does anybody have anything they wanted to share from that, that came out of that?
I tell the story, but I told this for both sort of things. It was about in the 70s, I was following a guru.
Uh-huh.
And with that comes a lot of giving away your power. I can't remember what the original question was now because I had them both merged in my head. But and I lived in an ashram for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very difficult and very trying. But during that time, there was a point where I left. I thought long and hard before I left, and then I finally left. But I can't say it was black and white.
Yeah.
It was because there was a lot of good that came out of it.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of letting go and taking. I didn't drink the Kool-Aid, because that's not my nature. But I did, I was in the ashram, so I drank the Kool-Aid that much.
Right.
And, because I really wanted to try to live the lifestyle, and I really wanted to try to do that, and, but it just never worked for me.
Yeah.
And until I had to finally get to that point, and what didn't work was, he really was, and I still don't know, he really was trying to deify himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I was saying to the group was, one of the, as odd as it sounds, one of the gifts from that was the gift of devotion.
Yeah.
It was lovely. It really was lovely. And there's no way to explain that.
Mm-hmm.
And but when with that gift of devotion comes that thing of losing yourself. You have to, so there's a you have to really learn. It's a big gift, because with that you have to really go, wait a minute, be careful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's amazing. And that is part of what I think you were asking, how can you be careful about losing yourself, getting lost in the teachings, because the stories with, especially in Hinduism, the stories are, the teacher tells you to drive off the cliff, will you do it? Literally, this is what you get taught. Would you walk off the cliff if the teacher tells you that? And of course, me, I'm like, no. But people would talk about
people
that.
Talk about that, yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay, we're not going so extreme.
No.
It's a similar idea, because the Buddha's clear. I think we can step away from the particular content of what's being asked, 108 vows or whatever it is. The Buddha's clear that we have to have a particular attitude, actually. The view of the mind, the approach, the way we're interacting with the teachings actually influences how far down the path we go.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a subtle point, because we have to do stuff on the path. We can't just start from where we are and snap ourselves to enlightenment. And what we do matters in some sense, but the way we do it is kind of what the Buddha ultimately points back toward. And there's this balance in it of giving yourself over to something, because you're going to transform into something that you don't understand what it is right now. But how to do that in a wise way. So I have this lovely quote from Bhikkhu Bodhi, who wrote an essay called Two Faces of the Dhamma. And he says, when we try to determine our own relationship with the Dhamma, eventually we find ourselves challenged to make sense out of its two seemingly irreconcilable faces. The empiricist face turned toward the world, telling us to investigate and verify things for ourselves, and the religious face turned to the beyond, advising us to dispel our doubts and place trust in the teacher and his teaching. Yeah. So you can think about those, like, how do those operate in you? You don't have to have the answer, but it's just something to notice. Now, one way that people resolve this, of course, is that they just choose one, and they just go with one side or the other. I don't think that's, and ignore the other one. They become faith types or they become skeptical types. I don't think that's entirely wrong. There may be times in our practice where we have to just do one or just do the other. So I don't criticize people that are in that mode. But I think in the long run, we can't do only one. I think we're either going to switch to the other one or start doing both of them or alternating, something like that. And this is also supported, actually, in the suttas, this notion that you're going to have both of these present. You don't have to choose. You have to rise above and have both of them. So here is a stock description in at least two suttas of how the path unfolds. It's got like 12 steps to it. And I'm just going to use the male pronoun because that's what's in there. With the arising of faith, he visits the teacher and grows close to them, close to him. So this is talking about the practitioner. With the arising of faith, he visits the teacher and grows close to him. Growing close, he lends ear. Lending ear, he hears the Dhamma. Hearing the Dhamma, he remembers it. Remembering it, he penetrates the meaning of the Dhamma. Penetrating the meaning, he comes to a reflective understanding of it. There being a reflective understanding, desire arises. With the arising of desire, he becomes willing. Willing, he contemplates. Contemplating, he makes an exertion. Exerting himself, he both realizes the ultimate meaning of the truth with his body and sees it by penetrating it with discernment. That's Tom Jeff's translation, so it would be a little different in the book, in Bhikkhu Bodhi's book. But so essentially, did you catch both sides? So it begins with faith. I'm not going to read them all again, but it begins with faith in the teacher, according to this version. And he grows close to him. So you have to somehow approach the teachings. And that could be the book that you read and you just love that author, whatever it is, or Audio Dharma or Dharma Seed. So then you listen because this is something in you is stirred. And this is a common experience I hear among even very rational types. They say, I don't know what it was, but just something about it made sense to me. The first time I heard the Dharma, I knew that made sense. So that's effectively this quality of faith or trust or a sense that it's the right thing for me. So then you listen. Listening, now remember this is a place where they didn't have books to read. So listening you remember, so you're going to memorize the teachings so that you can keep them in mind. And then it says you penetrate the meaning, you figure out what it's saying, and then you reflect and decide that it makes sense. So there's another level. You start with the faith, the sense that it's right, and then there's a reflective step later after you've listened, and you're supposed to really check. Does this, it even says agreement through pondering, actually, in Tom Jeff's version. And then after that, you become willing to practice. All this stuff about being willing, desire arises, being willing, contemplating, and exerting, that means sitting on the cushion. So you've decided it's going to make sense to you. So then you sit down and you follow the instructions. You follow your breath, or you do concentration practice, or you do metta practice, whatever you've been given. And then from that, there was this stuff about realizing the ultimate meaning. But essentially it means you come to an experiential understanding of the teachings. You have a deep insight. Your mind does transcend in some way. And you gain wisdom through that. So we need both. It's I don't think it has to go literally in this order, but I think it's very interesting that the description of the path includes both of those components. The Buddha himself did both, actually. Remember that the Buddha, I don't know if you know the story of the Buddha, or the one that comes to us at least, there are some different versions of it, but essentially he knew he needed to learn something, and he was restless in his home life and went out. And he first studied with the teachers of the time. He went and learned concentration practices with the best meditation teachers out there. And he succeeded very well, apparently, and was even asked to teach those teachings. But he understood inside that that wasn't actually what he was looking for. He wasn't looking for just concentrative attainment. And so he left, and he didn't stay in those communities. And so that takes an incredible amount of faith, because he realized there was no teacher for him. Well, he went and practiced with some ascetics after that and did a lot of body mortification practices. But he realized there wasn't somebody out there who already knew what he was looking for. And so that was, eventually he was driven to sit under the Bodhi tree and just figure it out for himself. But so he had an incredible amount of faith. He believed that there was something that no one was even talking about, didn't even exist in that world. What deep faith to say, no, what I feel is what I'm going for. That is really the most important thing, and it can be found. And he found it. But it wasn't only the faith. I mean, the faith was required for sure. But notice that there is discernment along that path. Like, first he discerned that the home life wasn't working for him. That's a pretty basic level. But then he discerned that the concentrative attainments, which are very blissful, by the way, very easy to get caught in, and those teachers pretty much said, this is the aim. Once you get to this state of mind, you've got it. You know, your mind is so bright, so powerful. The Buddha said, no, I'm looking for the end of suffering. And it doesn't end with this concentration, because then I still have to eat and sleep, and my body has needs. So there was, again, some discernment. These teachings aren't quite it for me. There wasn't the reflective acceptance. And then he did self-mortification practices, and he tried to transcend his body by crushing it, basically, by grinding it into the ground. And he realized that didn't work either. Boy, talk about really trying everything and failing. If you think you've failed a few times in your life, don't worry. the Buddha took many different paths to get to where he did. So it included consideration, assessing that certain paths weren't working for him. And then he actually had a memory of an experience he had as a child sort of a concentration state, but not like the deep immaterial states that he was practicing. It was just the first jhana, the concentration through the body. And he realized that might be the path forward. So he even used his own personal background, his own personal history, to discern the path forward. So I think it's clear that we have to use all our faculties, including our heart, including our mind, including our intuition, including our rationality in some sense, but at the right time. And I'm not saying that this is easy to navigate. Even as dedicated practice develops, we're continually called to let go and have faith in the next step unfolding. We might have to do something different than we were doing before. Experience gets different as meditation deepens and things may change. So we have to kind of ride this process, continue to use our discernment. Maybe a broader definition of faith is the willingness to be open to whatever is happening, no matter how beautiful or how horrible it is, and just not just how we treat explicit teachings, but how we treat the teaching, quote unquote, of our experience flowing each moment of our life unfolding, and the input that we're receiving. So faith is our willingness to meet that, in a sense, and then the deepest sense of inquiry is to really say, what is that, and which way is it going? I find this topic interesting also because in my own practice, when I started practicing, I did have this intuitive sense of, okay, this is something that really resonates for me. I'm really going to try this, even though I couldn't quite articulate it. But I'm kind of my mind has a tendency to be more rational, and I come from a scientific background originally, although I don't do that anymore. And there was a stage in my practice where I deliberately let go of rational thought. I mean, not completely, but regarding the practice, I decided to just let the process unfold. And for a while, for example, I didn't study the suttas. Well, I didn't study them in an academic sense. I think I did read them for inspiration, but I never really, I never tried to take an academic course or, you know, read any scholarly writings about them, because somehow I knew that was going to pollute them in some way for me. I really needed to take in the suttas as instructions, as poetry, as something just to engage with more at the heart level. And interestingly, just in the last, you know, some years, I've started to read scholarly articles. I took a course where I had to write papers about the suttas, and, you know, not just from my practice perspective, I had to compare and have footnotes and things like that. And it felt like it was time to start doing that. But I don't have any regrets. In fact, it was, I think, good that I didn't engage that part of my mind right away, that I had a period where I really was practicing more on faith and exploring more with my heart. And now, of course, there's a need for integration because that part of my mind is there. I need to bring it in some way. But it's just good to be open to the way those things can flow back and forth. So the Buddha talks about people eventually becoming their own teachers, essentially. And there's this phrase, to become independent in the Dhamma. And that means, doesn't mean you get everything right, but it means that you have the ability to navigate yourself. When you're going too far to the left, you're going to figure it out at some point and start going to the right. Yeah, those were my thoughts on this topic. But I'm curious if you have anything else you'd like to share, anything that's come up from this. There's no grand conclusion here because this is a balance. But I'm opening the topic as something that you might find interesting to look at in your own practice and in your own mind. Where am I relative to these different dimensions? And you know, how does that sit for me to hear about them? If you have any immediate thoughts, you could share with the group.
I just remember starting out just the way you described, thinking, I remember thinking, I don't need to learn another subject.
Right.
I really don't need that. That's the same thing I've always been doing. But then after a while, I wanted to study the suttas, and I did that for a while, and I'm still doing that. And now I'm starting to feel like, I don't know if this was that useful. That's where I'm kind of at. It's interesting, but
it's
interesting. Really very useful. So that's kind of where I'm, yeah.
Maybe you're ready for something deeper experiential. Not to suggest anything for you, but just, yeah, it's great that you can kind of follow that along and be open to the changes.
Yeah.
Seems like for balance, for me, it seems like there's a dynamicism to it that, when you freeze frame it in one particular instance, like a skater doing a move, it looks very off balance in the or one sided or, you know, asymmetric, but in the full view of the video of the full movement, there's balance throughout, I guess. In total.
That's a great analogy for this dynamic balance.
Well, it goes back and forth. Yeah. There's this centripetal motion almost that keeps it together.
Yeah. That force in the mind is mindfulness, actually. Is it that awareness is what helps balance keeps the mind from getting too far on one side or the other. It's mindfulness. Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you.
It's interesting how most of the examples you start with faith and then it goes to investigation, like to get you started.
The Buddha's pretty clear that faith comes first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's fairly natural in that if I didn't have any sense that something would be of value, I'm sure I wouldn't do it, and I probably wouldn't do it. So even if you're doing something and you're not quite sure of the value, or you still have some skepticism, there's got to be something that's pulling you. So, for example, in the five faculties, which is one of those lists, faith is first followed by energy. So you first have some sense that something's worthwhile, and then you devote yourself, you are willing to put energy into it. But yeah.
Seems like you like give it a try.
And yeah, then you go, you're willing to give it a try.
Then it snowball kind of builds on it.
Yeah.
Because you see the results and you're investigating
and,
it.
And then you have some material with which to analyze and investigate. Yeah, but there has to be that initial willingness. Well, you just think about, you know, how many people there are in the world and how many of them actually engage in meditation. Very small fraction, right? So for a lot of people, there's just no interest, no willingness. There's no faith, essentially. And it's whatever, however their mind is put together or whatever stage they're at or we're all the ones that are crazy, you know. I don't know, but you just look at the overall quality of the world and you see that only a small fraction has this willingness to do this. Mm-hmm. That's just how it is. Yeah.
I think myself for work, I sit around with the leadership team and people share how they have like these nervous breakdowns and mental breakdowns. And I was like, I'm not experiencing that, you know? It's good, you know? Mm-hmm. And people will ask me, like, how come you're always calm? How come, you know? And like I was sharing earlier with the group, I'm in social services, so we deal with crises every day, you know, and out in the community. And people who work with people in crisis, you know, sometimes you absorb a lot of that energy and negativity or stress or whatever, maybe. So, and recently, colleagues were like, I had a nervous breakdown, literally a breakdown where they're crying and just chaos in their own mind. And I was like, I don't want to be that person, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, coming to the center here and finding other ways and doing some readings, and I'm still pretty new at this, you know, really was able to find like that outlet for me, because it is a lot to absorb as a human.
It's good self-care for you.
Self-care, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and so within that balance, there's also times where I feel that I can't always be so calm. There's also like a call to action.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
I have to be more assertive and advocate or whatever my role may be there. But so the balance piece here that we discussed really applies to like my work life, you know. Uh-huh. I still have to figure out like my personal life, because I'm like, just, it's all work, you know. So yeah. I guess, you know, that's a whole other kind of reflection. But it's definitely work.
Great. Well, I appreciate your bringing in that dimension of the call to action versus the remaining calm. You, in a way, you've pointed toward next week's teaching, which is about cultivation compared to letting go. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of that same quality of when do we act and develop and push toward things, and when do we just let go and let things unfold. Mm-hmm. Yeah.